on Wednesday at this time. We do This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis. Anna, I noticed that on this day in 1984, the Bulls chose Michael Jordan. And, of course, he was at the University of North Carolina. They chose him third in the NBA draft. And this is also a date important in Michael Jordan history in 1996, right?
1996, Bob. Good morning. People will remember this. Just an unforgettable moment for Bulls fans, for sure. June 16th, 1996. Yeah, June was a big month for Michael Jordan's history with Chicago. But this is the point when Chicago had already seen the Bulls three-peat. Jordan had come back, and this was his fourth NBA championship victory. A deeply emotional victory for Jordan personally. As you'll recall, Bob, the Father's Day victory over the Sonics. Remember, Jordan had just lost his dad a few short years earlier, tragically murdered, and Jordan had dedicated the game to his father. Who can forget how visibly emotional he was after that game, lying on the locker room floor is an image we'll all remember, like just clutching the ball and crying, you know? Mm-hmm. Seconds after the final buzzer, we pulled a clip here, Bob. Jordan couldn't contain himself from the second it was over as he was asked what this championship meant to him by NBC's Ahmad Rashad. We pulled that clip.
Michael, I know that the first one was sweet, but how much sweeter was this one?
Well, you know, this, I can't even put it in words. My father's like what it means to me. I know he's watching. To my wife, and to my kids, and to my mother, my brothers and sisters. This is for Daddy. I'm very happy for him.
Now, you had said, Michael, that of all the accomplishments that you've made, that this may be the accomplishment. Why?
Well, this goes right up there to having my kids. My kids are the most important things to me, my wife, my family. But next to them, this is going to mean a lot to me because of what it symbolizes, which is my father on Father's Day.
He was teary-eyed in that moment, wasn't he?
For sure. You know, you think about what his dad meant to him and the tragedy of his death and that kind of thing. Fast forward to this Father's Day, just a couple days ago, Bob, I don't know if you saw it, Michael Jordan's kids posted a very different kind of message to him. Just incredibly lighthearted, a social media post calling out all the siblings and then saying, Dad, drink a shot of tequila for us this Father's Day. Extra añejo while you're at it, just celebrating their dad. And, you know, that's pretty cool, too.
Back to 1994 now and the O.J. Simpson Chicago connection.
You know, this is interesting, Bob. A lot of us forget. You know, if you were alive in 94 and had access to a television, you'll probably remember the slow Bronco chase, the trial, of course. But a lot of people forget how Chicago played a key role, at least initially, in the O.J. Simpson murder case. Chicago was where O.J. Simpson went the night of the murders. So Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman had just been found dead at 12:20 a.m., and then O.J.'s plane took off for Chicago 20 minutes later. He checked into the Plaza Hotel near O'Hare Airport. And then the murders became public. It was making international news. LAPD detectives flew here thinking there was some sort of key evidence. You know, did he bring some of the evidence with him in that duffel bag he carried? Did he bury something outside the Plaza Hotel? There were people who said that they had seen him acting suspiciously out in the dirt digging or something. So they were here to check out all these leads, came out here just thinking there was going to be a lot here to uncover. We pulled a clip from Channel 2 back in the day explaining how police were searching the areas O.J. visited in Chicago.
Chicago police assisted the L.A. officers in going over the woods across the street from the O'Hare Plaza Hotel. It was an apparent metal detector search for the weapon used to kill Nicole Simpson and Ronald Goldman. As of this morning, there was a plan to bring police dogs into the area, but we're told the plan was called off after the two LAPD detectives talked to their bosses on the West Coast and learned that the murder charges were about to be filed, that the web of evidence against O.J. Simpson was tight enough to arrest him. Now, the two LA officers, we are told, got on a plane this afternoon at O'Hare and have now returned to the West Coast. While they were here, those two LA officers worked closely with several Chicago detectives. I talked with one of those Chicago officers this afternoon. He characterized the case against O.J. Simpson this way. They've got the guy tight, he said. I wish I could have that case.
June 13th, 1994, when they found the bodies.
Yeah, and detective actually called O.J. at the O'Hare Hotel to say, you know, talk to him for 30 minutes at that time and tried to encourage him to come back to L.A. Of course, as we know, all the focus of detectives moved to L.A. and his neighborhood and the crime scene after that point. Not much was found in Chicago, but interesting connection. Think about that.
For sure. And very interesting what happened here with Metra this week in 1984. Talk about this.
40 years ago, Bob. Do you take the Metro ever?
No. I'm a CTA L guy.
CTA L guy. I usually am, too, except for when I'm going to Ravinia. But, you know, that's but I'm very grateful for the Metro when I have it. And I always find it to be clean and you know, it's a rather pleasant experience. And this week, 40 years ago, it was anything but. It was 1984. Suburban rail transport got a huge boost when the Metro board was formed. It was out of total need, Bob, because back then it had fallen into complete just decline physically, financially. By the late 70s and 80s, there was this not-so-funny joke that people could see the train tracks through the rusty holes in the floors of the train cars. Like, it was really getting bad. The fares had doubled, and the service declined, and the operational costs reduced, almost going to collapse the whole rail system. So the Metro Board comes in and state funding along with it. So this week, lawyer Jeffrey Ladd, who had taken the train in and out of the city every day from McHenry County, became the head of the board, and Metra made a comeback, major. They brought new train cars. They upgraded the crumbling bridges and infrastructure. They started new train services to new places and extended the popular rail lines, and it was super popular again. People were using it to commute back and forth, you know, out of the city. And by the way, Bob, it wasn't called Metra initially. They brought in some fancy marketing team to come up with names. And the top four names were Cord, Corta, Track, and Metra. Could have been taking the Cord, but Metra was it because they decided that that was a good name to represent this elaborate network of trains that unified the metropolitan area.
So this week, 40 years ago. You talk about Chicago history, go back to 1963 and Barbara Streisand right here, Anna.
I just love this story, Bob. You know, so you think about 1963, up-and-coming young performer named Barbara Streisand staged a very memorable two-week engagement in Chicago at Mr. Kelly's, the legendary Rush Street nightclub. Ever go to Mr. Kelly's, Bob? Does that bring back any memories?
Yeah, Mr. Kelly's. I remember the Happy Medium. And, Mr. Kelly's is where Gibson's is now, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly there. And it was like the club for all the performers nationwide would come through there, you know, the members of the Rat Pack. And you think of, you know, all the comedians. There'd be a lot of, you know, major comedians who got their start there, too. At this point, Barbara Streisand, just barely 21 years old, captivated the Chicago crowds who came to see her. And Barbara said she was captivated by Chicago, too, said it was an important city for her back when she got her start. We pulled this great clip, Barbara Streisand describing how Chicago has always held a special place in her heart, and something extremely memorable happened here this week, 60 years ago.
I first came to Chicago when I was 21 years old to sing at Mr. Kelly's, a little nightclub on Rush Street. And one night after the show, I went with a photographer who had been hired to shoot a magazine article about me. He took me down to the Oak Street beach, and we took a bunch of shots there. I love the mood and memory of that early morning shoot so much that about a year later, when I was looking for a photo for the cover of my People album, I chose one of the pictures from that beach shoot. The funny thing is, though, I picked one with my back to the camera. I gave it to Columbia Records at the time and said, let's use this as the cover. And some people at the label thought that was a terrible idea. You know, they kept saying, we want to see your face. Anyway, it was a sweet little victory when the People cover won the Grammy Award for Best Album Cover. I like to think that Chicago has always brought me good luck.
Yeah, and what was it, $2.50 to see her?
Isn't that crazy? $2.50, Bob, and two drink minimum. That would have got you in to see Barbara Streisand back in the day. Not the case anymore. So cool.
And were the reviews great off the bat?
You know, it's interesting because I dug up some of this stuff, too. I read a bunch of the reviews from the time, and most of them were just glowing. Sun-Times columnist Irv Kupcinet, who was the man at the time, he went to see her that very first night. and wrote that Streisand was absolutely fantastic. They put that on the Mr. Kelly's marquee the night after that, and it just lasted for the whole engagement. Another columnist, though, at Chicago Daily News, Bob, wrote that Barbara Streisand sounded like a cross between a sweet-voiced canary and a whooping crane. Who would say that about Barbara? I'm, like, amazed by that. But anyway, that didn't make the marquee. What did was the Herb Cup Sedit line, and, you know, mm-hmm. just so cool to think about, you know, that moment in time.
And finally, we remember a Chicago treasure, a bakery that's still open on Grand Avenue. Tell us about D'Amato's history.
Still open, Bob. Still love this bakery. I was there not too long ago. Just like it is, was back in the day. Legendary Chicago Bakery got its start 1971 this week from an unlikely source. A construction worker started it. Nick D'Amato had been working construction since immigrating from Italy with his wife. And he lived on Grand a couple doors down from the bakery. His son used to hang out there after school. The owners let him stay there because they were at work and his wife was at work. And he said he learned how to bake amazing breads and make amazing cookies. And so one day he decided to take over the bakery. It became the family business. And they just started doing all those wonderful Italian cannolis, cookies, and just all those great things they still do to this day. They now supply breads to over 400 restaurants, so it's like a real, including La Scarola and a lot of other names that you'd recognize. So D'Amato's still going strong, still exactly like it was back in the day. The only thing that's changed, Bob, is about 5 years ago, they got rid of that bronze cash register where they pull the big lever down like jackpot style and give
fine,
you cash. And
finally,
they only took cash. They only took cash until a couple years ago, but now they actually will accept your credit card. So.
I'm hungry. I'm going to 1124 Grand Avenue after the show.
So good.
Thank you, Anna. Talk to you next week.
Bye.